morning to the book of Ruth. We're continuing our series called The Story, and we're just chronologically going through the entire Bible this year. And of course, those of you who've been here know we're just kind of taking great big chunks at a time. And this morning we're going to cover the entire book of Ruth. So, Ruth chapter 1. Have you seen those videos that you might see on YouTube or possibly Facebook where a child gets a gift? And the one I saw, and there are several ones similar to this, this young boy, I guess he's probably 10 years old, you can tell he's expecting something really special. And you can see the excitement. You can see the anticipation. You can even see the joy on his face as he's getting ready to open this particular gift. And apparently, this little boy is expecting an Xbox. So he just starts shredding the paper to get that Xbox. But instead of getting an Xbox, he gets this. A pottery wheel. Make pottery at home fun for the whole family. And he's confused. How could this happen? How could my parents not understand what I told them? I thought I made myself perfectly clear. What have I done to deserve this? I mean, isn't it just enough all the things I've done for them just by being here and existing? And then you see the confusion kind of turn to anger and hurt. Why me? Of all the kids in the world who ask for an Xbox, why am I the one that gets the pottery wheel? And then from there, the anger starts settling in. And on this particular video, he takes the box, the pottery wheel box, and he flings it across the room. And he's shouting at his parents, and he's angry, and he stomps out of the room, and he slams the door. You know, as parents, as we get older, as we become adults, we get a little bit better at handling disappointment. But I think most of us probably, at least while his reaction certainly is not the way to handle those kind of things, we get better at handling disappointment. I mean, we know what it's like to expect one thing and to get another. Most of us have experienced that. We know what it's like to have a hope in a particular area of life and then to end up disappointed. When it comes to presents, I think we get a lot better at disguising and masking it if we're disappointed. And if you're married, you know exactly what I'm talking about. From time to time, your spouse just disappoints you. I mean, ladies, you know what it's like. You tell your husband, you know, over and over, I want these shoes. And I need these shoes and this particular size. And you make sure he knows. But your husband, he wants to think outside the shoebox. And so you open your, get your birthday present, and it's the right size. Looks like a shoebox. And you eagerly anticipate what might be inside, so you open it up. There's no shoes. There's like a box of Nutrisystem food or a blender or something in it. Or guys, you know how this goes too, right? You make it clear to your wife, I want the newest iPhone. Every time you're in a store, you go by that display with the phones. You go, that's the one I want, honey. And you emphasize it over and over. Then your birthday comes around. Looks like the right size box. And then you open it up, and it's like a pair of electronic nose clippers or something. You know, sometimes you get what you need rather than what you want, that kind of experience. We all know what it's like to have those types of moments. And we've kind of learned to swallow the bitterness. We pretend that everything's all right, but on the inside, maybe we're stomping and slamming the doors. just wonder if some of you might kind of experience this in a much more crucial part of life. Maybe you're graduating from college, and 4 years ago there was all this excitement and there was all this joy, and you just knew when you got out of college, man, you were going to have life by the horn, so to speak. And now you're graduating, you don't have anything lined up, and it looks like you're going to have to move back home. Your parents don't want that, you don't want that, but it just kind of seems to be the only option, and the joy and the anticipation's gone. There's kind of this disappointment. You're becoming disillusionment set in. Or maybe you've been graduated for a while and you're in a career. Maybe you've been there 5 or 10 years. And you've taken off the wrapping paper and you've taken off the bow. And it's not what you thought it was going to be. And you're disappointed. And you thought it was going to be an Xbox, but it's not turned out like that. Your career hasn't. It's like the pottery wheel. Or how about marriage? You know, something happens sometimes in marriage. The wedding day, there's all this joy and anticipation and excitement. And you know, sometimes in a marriage, it takes a little while to unwrap everything, but eventually you get it unwrapped, and there's kind of been some disappointment, and it's not quite, he or she's not quite who you thought they were, and there's some things that you're having to work through. I just know in all of our stories, there's been situations like that. Scenarios where we thought we were getting this, but life has turned out to go in this direction. That's the situation we see in the book of Ruth. If we had a video camera and we were videoing here, we would see all types of expressions. We would see the joy and the excitement. We would see the hurt and the disappointment and the confusion. And this story just kind of reflects any life that's lived long enough. Now, as you read this book, I think it's interesting to ask yourself some questions, particularly this question. Why is this book here? Because when you read the book, it just doesn't seem like it fits in the Bible. It's a book that was written during the time of the judges, but it's not about a judge. And you read it, and it seems like it's not really even about the nation of Israel. And you read it, and it seems like, well, it's just about this one particular family, and that family doesn't seem to have any prominence or any significance to them. And so you just kind of ask yourself, why is this book even in the Scriptures? And it's the story about a husband by the name of Elimelech and his wife, Naomi. Ladies, how would you like to have a husband whose name is Elimelech? I mean, I guess I get easily amused, but can you see her standing there with her hands on her hips? Elimelech, pick your socks up! Just something about that name. Now, we don't know a whole lot about Naomi, but we know her life, or her name means sweet, and that she describes her life as being full and satisfied. And I want you to just picture, because this happens before the book kind of actually starts. They get married. And there's that joy, and there's that anticipation, and there's that excitement as they get married. And then we're told that they have 2 sons. And so life is kind of going according to plan. And you know that she's living life and enjoying it. And so we're going to pick up in Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. It reads, "In the days when the judges ruled, there was famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and 2 sons, went to live in the country of Moab." So when we pick up this story, already the expression has kind of changed. There's some confusion because there's famine in this land now. And the famine has been there for some time. And the famine is so severe that this family can't stay there any longer. You know, I think in our culture, we can't really grasp what it would be like to have a famine so severe that we would have to move. I mean, I think it's hard to relate to. And I just want to maybe kind of personalize this a little bit, maybe bring it down to maybe something we might could identify with a little bit better. Just imagine, and some of you may have experienced this, just imagine your husband comes home from work one day and he just doesn't seem himself. And you try to talk to him and see what's going on, but he won't have any part of it. He turns on the TV and he sits down and he's looking at the TV, but he's not really watching it. And you sit down for supper and he just seems distant, but he won't talk. And finally, you're lying in bed that night, and in the pitch darkness, he says, "They let me go today." And you say all the right things. "It'll be okay. You know, I can pick up some extra shifts at work. We'll make ends meet. It'll get better. Everything will be okay. We'll get through this." 6 months later, your savings is deleted. You've had to sell all but one of your cars. You had to sell your house and move into an apartment. And things still aren't getting better. And things just keep getting worse. And you think to yourself, "I can't believe the things that I used to think about. I used to worry about my retirement. And I used to worry whether or not the Bulldogs were going to win this weekend. And I used to worry about what I was going to wear. But now I'm just worried about getting food for my two boys." And you sit down at night and you get on your knees with your little boys. And it's hard to concentrate on prayers because you can hear their stomachs growl. And things aren't turning around. And you're worried, "How am I going to feed my kids?" I think most of us have quite been in that predicament. That's what's going on here. And finally, the husband says, "You know what? We got to go. We cannot stay here anymore. We don't have anything to eat." So they get up, or they get their stuff together, what they can, and they move to a country called Moab. It's time for a fresh start. Sometimes people do that kind of thing. But you have to understand, this is a huge step for them to leave. Remember, it was 700 years before they finally got to the Promised Land. The Promised Land was divided up for the tribes, and then each family in that tribe, they were given some land. This is their land to pass on, each family, from generation to generation. It was part of their identity. They're going to have to give all that up. Walk away from that. That would be extremely difficult to do. And they're going to Moab. The Moabites. They're descendants of the Sodomites, of Sodom. They're evil people. They don't have anything to do with God. They're the enemy, so to speak. It's hostile country. They don't have any choice. They don't have anything to eat. Think about what Naomi may have been thinking at this point. "I've lost my house. I've lost my land. But hey, I still have my God. I still have my husband. He's a good man. And I still have my two children. Strong, healthy boys." So the story continues in verses 3 and 4 of chapter 1. "Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. And she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth, and after they had lived there about 10 years. So they get to Moab and her husband gets sick and he's not getting better. Eventually, they're in this foreign hostile country and her husband dies. She has the two boys, she raises the boys, and they marry Moabite women. Finally, it looks like things are turning the corner for Naomi, right? Two weddings. I mean, it's like the Forsters of the Old Testament, right?" Forsters have two weddings coming up with two of their daughters. But that's what this is like. There's excitement. There's a wedding. Maybe there's going to be grandchildren. But then the scriptures tell us the two sons die. Two weddings followed by two funerals. I mean, if this lady didn't have bad luck, there wouldn't be any luck at all, right? I mean, it's just awful. And she's experiencing incredible grief. Edgar Jackson makes some statements about grief that I think really personalize it. And I know there's folks in this room today that you could have written this. He defines grief like this. He said, "Grief is a silent, knife-like terror and sadness that comes 100 times a day when you start to speak to someone that is no longer there. He said, grief is the emptiness that comes when you eat alone after eating with another for many years. He said, grief is teaching yourself to go to bed without saying goodbye to the one who has died. He said, grief is the helpless wishing that things were different when you know they are not and they will never be again. Some of you completely get that, and I'm sorry. And you understand the loss, and you understand the disappointment. And sadly, those kind of days come for everybody. It's not something that you're exempt from. Naomi is experiencing just an inordinate amount of loss, just one thing after another. And I've spoken with many of you through the years that are hurting, and you have told me things like, I know there are other people who are hurting just the way that I'm hurting. And you say things like, I know my family means well, and I know my church family means well. And they say, it's going to be okay, and it's going to be better. Just let some time go by. But I still experience loneliness. I want to try to help us put a face to what's going on this morning. Steve Davidson lost his wife 5 years ago this week. And I've asked him to come up and read a poem entitled Broken.
Do you see that pile of wood chips on the floor? That's what's left of life I had before. When I was loved by you with all your heart, when passion awoke and played its part. Our oneness and purpose, agreement and thought, is something that could not be bartered or bought. It seemed to be perfect to have heaven's blessings, each word, gaze and touch was a form of caressing. I never known such love before. Now all that remains is that pile on the floor. It looks to others like I'm doing all right. They don't see the wood chip of crying all night. My family and friends think I'm doing okay. The wood chip is hidden of my struggle each day. So many chips in that pile on the floor, emptiness, loneliness, disappointment, and more. Dreams unfilled, plans hung in midair. Love uncomplicated beckons, images so rare. My life has been broken. Nothing fits anymore. There's a big pile of wood chips in the middle of my floor.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate you sharing. You know, that's how Naomi felt. Her life was just this pile of wood chips, broken pieces. She's lost everything. And so she finally decides, being in this hostile country, that she has no choice but to go back home. And she tells her two daughter-in-laws, Ruth and Orpah, look, you stay here. You're young women. You can get married again. You can have families. You can have kids. But I have to go back. Orpah agrees to stay. But Ruth's daughter-in-law, she just refuses. And she says to her mother-in-law in verse 16 of chapter 1, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. So here's this daughter-in-law talking to her mother-in-law. And some of you are probably thinking, that text, it sounds very familiar. And it probably does because it's a text that's used in a lot of weddings. Now let me point out something here. If we were really going to be true to this text, usually when this text is read, the bride and the groom are standing there and they're holding hands and there's, you know, smiles and all that kind of stuff. But if and they read that text. But if we were going to be true to the text, what really needs to happen is the bride needs to turn from her husband and look at the mother-in-law and have that read. I'm guessing that's not going to become a tradition, right? I don't see that happening. But that's what's going on here. There's this special relationship between the daughter-in-law and the mother-in-law. It goes on in verse 18. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So Ruth and Naomi, they make a journey back to Naomi's hometown. They go across the mountain, and they come back to Bethlehem. Now you're starting to get an idea of why this book is in the Bible. At this particular point in history, Bethlehem is probably a town of about 200 people. It's a little town. Everybody knows everybody. So when Naomi comes back, everybody's like, is that Naomi? That doesn't look like Naomi. Who's that with her? Here's what Naomi says when people begin to notice her. Chapter 1, verse 21. The Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. If you were looking at the King James Version, I remember hearing a sermon about this when I was a teenager, and it always stuck with me. Naomi means sweet, and she says, change my name to Myra, if you're reading the King James Version, which means bitter. So she said, don't call me Naomi anymore, call me Myra. Don't call me sweet anymore, call me bitter, because my God hath dealt very severely with me. So she left full, husband, boys, healthy. She comes back and she's empty and she's angry with God. Can you see the expression on her face as she says these things? The Almighty has made me very bitter. It's like God didn't hold up his end of the deal here. It was supposed to be happily ever after. And instead I've endured all this misery. It's not my fault. Does any of this situation sound familiar? You just kind of reach the point where it feels like what you hope for, God's not going to deliver. That your dreams that maybe you had aren't going to come true. Things aren't working out. And you read this story and you read about Naomi, and here's the question. What's the story about? What's it really about? Is it just about loss? I mean, you say, well, it's easy. It's the story of this loss and tragedy. It's this lady who's like the female version of Job. That's what it's about. You can tell. Is that really what the story is? Is that what the story has to be about? Incredible pain and loss and misery? Is that what it, is that the only thing it can be about? Gerald Sitzer's a college professor. He's experienced tragedy in his life. He was in a car accident and lost three generations of his family. His mom, his wife, and his young daughter. He walked away. He wrote a book called Grace in Disguise. And he talks about his journey after those three family members passed away. Here's a sentence that sticks out. The experience of loss does not need to be the defining moment of our story. Do you hear what he's saying? Loss does not have to be the defining moment. The story can be about our response to loss. In other words, we don't get to decide what roles we play in the story of our lives, but we do get to decide how we'll play the role that we're given. See the difference there? We don't get to decide what roles we play in the story of our lives. We get to decide how we play the roles that we're given. Maybe you're experiencing loss today. You get to decide, is this going to define me? Is this what my life is going to be about? Is my life just going to be a story of loss? Or could the story be something different? I understand that. And I think it was hard for Naomi not to just get caught up in that lower story. You know, we talked about, if you're a guest this morning, we've kind of been talking about the lower story of our lives and the upper story. The lower story is kind of that 6-foot horizontal view. And it's what we can see, and it's sickness and jobs and all, just life. In her case, that 6-foot horizontal view is hurt and pain and misery. But the upper story is what God is doing that we can't always see. Could it be there's something bigger and better going on in the upper story? Right now, all we see is Naomi saying, "Don't call me sweet, I'm bitter." Here's what we're going to see. There's another word you can use to describe the story of Naomi, and it's redemption. It's what God is doing in that upper story that we don't always see. So we've kind of been in the first episode in chapter 1. Now we're going to kind of go to the second episode, so to speak. So Naomi and Ruth, they come back. And they come back to Bethlehem. And it's harvest time, and they don't have anything. But it's harvest time, and according to Levitical law, those that were wealthy, they would leave a certain amount of their harvest for the poor to come behind after and kind of pick the leftovers, so to speak. So Ruth, she doesn't realize this, but she actually picks a field that actually belongs to one of Naomi's relatives. But she's out there and she's picking up leftover food from the harvest. Maybe it's corn, I don't know what it is. But I want you to think about this. This is a small town. There's this foreigner out in a field. Okay, a foreigner. Now, put this in kind of our context. Can you imagine a lady in a burqa picking up corn in a field in Iowa? Can you say Homeland Security? Yeah, that's what we're talking about here. It's gonna get attention. People are going to notice this. But this field belongs to one of her relatives. She doesn't even know it when she goes out there. It's a relative of Naomi's, and his name is Boaz. And when he learns that she's the daughter-in-law of Naomi, he begins to shower blessings upon her. He begins to give her food, and he tells her that she can drink of the water that his men drink out of. And he tells his men, make this easy for her. Pull the stalks up so that she can do this and doesn't have to work so hard. And this is incredible kindness shown to a foreigner. I mean, foreigners just didn't have it that good when they went to a strange country. So when Ruth arrives home, she shares what's happened and how this man by the name of Boaz has been so kind to her. And Naomi kind of sees an opportunity here. She kind of sees where that upper story and this lower story can meet. And she begins to play matchmaker. And so she says to Ruth, "You need to clean up, take a shower, put on some perfume, Chanel No. 5, put on your Sunday best, then head over to Boaz's house." And she has to wait till Boaz finishes eating, because you don't want to bother a man on an empty stomach, right? So she goes over to Boaz's house, and this is going to sound really strange to us, but this is a cultural thing. After Boaz goes to sleep, she has instructions to go into where he's sleeping, go to the foot of his bed, and uncover his feet, and lie there. Now, to us, that seems a little bold, a little seductive, maybe. But you got to understand their culture. This is more her being bold and beautiful than young and restless. And it wouldn't have been looked upon as something seductive. So when Boaz awakes, this is what he says to her. And I'm in Judges chapter 3, verse 9 now. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." The word garment here is the same Hebrew word that's used as wing. And Ruth is asking Boaz to permanently spread his wing over her, to take her in and protect her. And it's another one of those cultural nuances. And according to their culture, he exercises his obligation and they get married. And when they get married, then he buys Naomi's husband's deceased land, Ruth's husband's deceased land, and his brother's deceased land. And so he owns all of that land. Now listen, this is all fascinating. But listen to the backstory of what's going on here. Why would Boaz, why would this wealthy guy do all of this? He has an obligation, but I think there's more to it than that. Do you know who his mom was? Boaz's mom? If you go to Matthew chapter 1, we read that Boaz's mom was Rahab. You remember Rahab from a few weeks ago, who sheltered the 12 spies that Joshua sent? And then was there when they knocked down the walls of Jericho? That Rahab, that's Boaz's mom. So it's like he understood what it was like to be the outsider looking in. Rahab was adopted into the family of Israel, and Boaz grew up to be this man who honored God and provided for those who were less fortunate. And he kind of shows this undeserved act of kindness. And God uses that to redeem the story. And Boaz reaches out. Ruth and Boaz have a little boy together. That little boy, again, one of those cultural nuances. Now he's going to inherit his father's land back when he's old enough. And his name is Obed. And that is, becomes, of course, Naomi's grandson. I know this all seems kind of weird, but it doesn't end there. And the amazing upper story, we read the genealogy at the end of the book of Ruth, and then we also see it in Matthew chapter 1. Obed has a son by the name of Jesse. Jesse has a son by the name of David. You know who David is? King David. And 28 generations later, they are part of the lineage of Jesus Christ in the little town. The upper story. God was taking all of those broken pieces and he was putting something beautiful, an incredible piece of art together. I started off this morning talking about the videos and the kids opening the presents. The look goes from confusion to hurt to anger. But the one I told you about where the kid gets the pottery box and he flings it across the floor and he stomps out of the room, well, the mom goes and gets him. She says, you've got to open the box. You have got to come and open the box. So the kid comes back and he opens the box. And she wasn't trying to be cute or, you know, play a prank on him. But there was an Xbox in the box and some extra controllers and extra games, and she couldn't get them all in to fit into the Xbox box. So she had to put him in this bigger box. But he had to open the box. Here's what I'm saying. Before you stomp out of the room and slam the doors, open the box. See what God has inside the box. You know what I love about the story of Ruth? And it's kind of different from a lot of the other stories we've looked at so far. There's not this big miracle. The walls of Jericho don't come down. The Red Sea doesn't split. Moses doesn't see somebody talking to him in a burning bush. Abraham doesn't have an audible voice come to him. It's not Noah's Ark. There's no big miracle here. But here's what is here. God is at work. God is at work in that lower story. He's at work in our lower story. Even we, maybe we don't feel like he is. God is at work. That's the message. It may seem too late. Maybe it feels too late. Maybe it seems too broken to you. But God is at work. Maybe it doesn't seem obvious. His hand doesn't necessarily seem apparent. But God is at work. It may not be dramatic, may not be firecrackers and all that kind of stuff, but God is still at work. It may not be immediate, but God is at work. So here's what I'm saying to you. See what's in the box. The box you're looking at may say divorced. It may say cancer. It may say infertile. It may say widow. It may say terminated. It might say abused. But don't let that be your story. Your story does not have to be about loss. Your story can be about redemption. Give God peace.